World War II, a time of unrelenting global trauma, stretching from 1939 to 1945. It involved all of the great powers of the time. It was the most destructive episode in the history of civilization. It required its major forces to dedicate their entire military, economic, industrial, and scientific capabilities to the cause of warfare. Estimates of the death toll vary, from 50 million to 85 million worldwide. World War II took the art of war to new and appalling heights through massacre, genocide, remorseless bombing raids, starvation, disease, and the first use of nuclear weapons. Leslie George Napier Brown's story offers another perspective on the complexity of World War II and its aftermath. Following infantry service in Darwin and New Guinea, Les Brown had a close-up view of the devastation of Japan as a member of the British Commonwealth Occupation Force. The existence he encountered there was far different from the mood of peace and order he'd known during his formative years in Adelaide.
I had a wonderful mum and dad, two sisters, and as we were growing up, we went our own way. But when I turned 8, my mother allowed me to join the Wolf Cubs, the Junior Scouts. And that was the beginning of almost a lifetime practice. Then when I turned 11, I became Scout age, and I was initiated as a Scout. But those days, you went through a ceremony, and you were also handed your broomstick. That is a scout stave. My scout master asked me to get one and have it with me on the night of my initiation. And so I bought one, but it wasn't a broom handle. They seemed too small in all directions, really. So I bought a rake handle. And today, I still have that scout stave.
I can see it across the room now, and accompanied by photographs of you much later in life, obviously very senior in the scouting movement, but we'll cover those stories. So clearly, from a very early age, the scouting movement was influential in your life. What was your first job outside the scouting? Where did you go to work?
I wasn't quite 14 when I was leaning over the fence on East Terrace, not far from the Victoria Racecourse, you know. The family lived in Angus Street. And I was just leaning in watching these two teams of kids playing football. I never played it myself. And I had a call from across the road. There were two or three mansions there, and I knew one of the gentlemen who lived there, he and his family. And I heard my name called, and I turned around. He beckoned me over. He says, "Leslie," he says, "would you like a job?" Wow. What a proposition it was, really. Especially we'd just gone through the Great Depression. And I did all I could to help my mum and dad during those days. But here, I'm offered a job. And I said, "Mr. Corbin, yes, I would like a job." I was 1 month off 14 at the time. And so on the Monday morning, I reported to Elder Smith & Company Limited, and I was there until I joined the Army. Now,
and what did you do in this job? What were your expectations in employment?
My job was storeman and packer. And I only had one boss, a very nice fellow. And I learned a lot. I learned how to carry heavy bundles and all that kind of thing. And but being with that company, I did not realise that in wartime, some companies cannot let their employees join the army or any service, because they've become essential services. To serve the whole of Australia, farm-wise, cattle stations and so on, and that they couldn't afford to allow any man not to carry out his job during wartime. And so, from Torrensville Parade Ground, I had to work on until 41. But in 1941, my boss called me to his office, and he said to me, "Leslie, I'm going to sack you." And I replied with a smile on my face, "Oh, thank you, sir." And so that was a permit for me to join the army. And at the same time, he stated, "Leslie, when you come back to us, and we hope you will, your job will be waiting for you."
So you were just over 20 by this stage, 20 years old.
Yes, I'm 20 and 8 months.
And so you enlisted in the Australian Army.
Yes.
And you enlisted in a famous...
Pardon?
You enlisted in a very well-known unit. Tell me about that.
Oh, yes. At the time, the 1,200 recruits, because I was picked up at the Torrensville with all these others, an arrangement with the Army. And we were taken to Warrilow. That was our first destination. And there, we went through very little, actually, being uniformed and getting into the bugle sounds, which are we found very important. And of course, we were issued with our gear, our mess gear especially. And from the second day, we were closer to being soldiers than ever before. But the whole thing worked out so smoothly.
But it wasn't long before you were up the sharp end, you were sent up to Darwin.
Yes. During the time at Warrilow, the only weapon we saw was the Lee Enfield 303. It was on a tripod, and the sights were sighted on a small white and black target. The object of the lesson was to aim correctly at any given target. On the day that we left Warrilow, nobody had any idea what was going to happen. It took a whole day for us to get to the railway station at Oaklands Park. And but by late afternoon, our part of the battalion was entrained. For myself, I thought we were going to go to Woodside because it was the main training ground in South Australia. But the train turned north and it went on and on and on. And then there was a change of trains, and we were told, because the railway line was different to the one we were going on. So we got on this train. Oh boy, I think it had been pulled out of a junkyard. It was so dilapidated, you know. And so we continued on. No stopping place, no food. And eventually, we finished up 1,000 miles from Adelaide, Alice Springs. There we did get a feed. And we were told by the sergeants, of course, we got NCOs from Woodside that had been in the army and were trained personnel. And we were told that we would be here 3 days so they'd get enough transport to take us to Larimar. Well, the point is, while we were at Alice Springs, what use were we? There wasn't a weapon between us. Only our bayonet, which was part of our webbing equipment. And a lot of the others, they said, yeah, Brownie, what's going on? Haven't the faintest idea. But anyway, on early one morning, we embussed and we started on that red, dusty 600 miles to Larimar. The one stop was near the Devil's Marbles. Everybody got off because the bladders were over full. And then back onto the trucks. But I was surprised to see how energetic all my mates were. We ran down to the hill to some of the big marbles that had been dislodged by conditions. And everybody seemed to be in a mood of a very young person. Admittingly, we were young, but the conditions we were travelling under made every one of those guys special to me. So back onto the trucks, and then through some of the well-known towns that we didn't know, to Larimar. Now, Larimar is the beginning of the railhead that goes to Darwin. And we found that our train was a cattle truck. It had been hosed down, made clean for us. And so we didn't mind about that because at least it was going to be flat travelling, not corrugated, red, dusty road, you know. And we got as far as Winelli. Now, Winelli was the main standard camp, training camp, 6 miles out of Darwin. And that's where we, after a shower, that's where we spent our first night close to Darwin.
And you were serving in the 27th Australian Infantry Battalion?
It was never mentioned, as you just said, but it was the 27th South Australian Scottish Regiment. Mm-hmm. And that's how we knew it, from the beginning of our service from Darwin and shipped to other theatres of war. We're nothing more than the Scottish Regiment.
But the official records call it the 27th Australian Infantry Battalion, but perhaps the familiar, the fond name, was the Scottish. Is that right?
Yeah. Even our band were all pipers.
Yes.
And Mac, the sergeant in charge, we used to hear the practice in our camp in Adelaide. I remember the colonel saying once, he says, Mac asked the colonel So we need some practice. Do you mind? And Colonel Farquhar said, well, I don't mind, but don't be less than 1 mile in any direction. A bit of a laugh over that. But
there were some rather more serious noises to be heard very soon, namely the bombing of Darwin and your experiences there. How did you handle that? What did you experience? What do you remember now of being bombed?
I remember very well. When we were given our battle area, because that's what it was called, in a 49.5 mile camp, and work started there. Every two men had to dig in. Talk about diggers, we were the World War II diggers, you know. And we built our trenches, camouflaged them as best we could. But that was the least of the work put our way. Because every day, a percentage of our battalion was motored to the southeast part of our coast and southeast of Darwin Harbour. The object of that was to put up shore defences, yes, barbed wire, Singapore posts, which are cement posts for machine gunners, and a bit inland from the coast was swampland. They had to build a road to get a ute in to feed those people. And that went on and on and on.
The bombing went on and on too. It was a very long, sustained campaign by the Japanese, wasn't it?
Oh.
What was it like experiencing that day after day?
On the 19th of February, 1942, we still had our men working on the shores. Just after 9 o'clock, we heard this hum of bombers. We heard them before we saw them. They were so high we couldn't recognise them. But we thought they were American reinforcements. But it didn't turn out that way. Oh. When they dropped their bombs on the harbour first, and then every target they could see, the sound was unbelievable. The smoke from the burning oil tanks on the coast of the harbour, the ships that had been sank. The sea caught fire, and I pitied the sailors trying to get to land and swim through. There was some help from little boats, but they could do very little. But they took them to the hospital ship. It was a Red Cross very clearly showing, and yet that was staffed and it was bombed also. But they were taking on casualties because that was nearer to the area than the harbour itself. Of course, that hospital ship was just outside the harbour and a bit further south.
Now, after the bombing, which went on day after day after day, long protracted bombing campaign. You were then posted. How long was it before you were posted up to New Guinea? What happened then, Liz?
Well, I must tell you before that, the colonel, because I was his driver, he had a problem. He had to get his men back from the shore defences. Yes. So while the bombing was going on, he mustered every vehicle he could. And when we heard the last plane go over, he says to me, "Corporal, let's go." So we led a large convoy of utilities and anything that would drive. And we got to the area where our men were waiting, fully equipped in battle dress, and because by this time they had their weapons. And we got them all aboard and back to our positions. And then, and of course, they had to get in the trenches. We didn't know what was going to follow. But what did follow about midday was the second formation of bombers. But the colonel was so happy that he's got his men back and in the trenches. No casualties. And from then on, it was just a matter of just waiting. We did not know if there would be an invasion.
Exactly.
Nobody knew. Nobody knew there was going to be a second raid.
But there were a number of raids. If you just pass me your memoirs there, the 2nd 27th Battalion memoirs, this depicts very clearly the progress of the war. And this is a book called The Chocolate and Blue Soldier. And we've got a number of instances here of what happened at Darwin, what happened after that, and where you went. And I would suggest that in that incredibly busy time of becoming even more of a professional soldier, you had some remarkable experiences. I see here you trained on the Atherton Tablelands in Queensland, and then you were off to the islands. Off you went on active service.
Off to Papua New Guinea.
Yes, here we are, New Guinea, overseas to active service in New Guinea.
Here I have the photos of the battalion in a battle area before and after the first raid.
Right.
So because on that first raid, the Japanese fighter was shot down. Yeah. But it had been following the Adelaide River, Darwin Road, main road, when something happened. It could have been damaged by AK-AK, or it could have run out of petrol, or it could have been shot down by our battalion, because by that time we were loaded with Lee Enfields, 303 rounds, and we had been given some tuition as to the firing and when to fire at a lone plane, because they came in low, you could see the pilot.
Yeah.
And on this day, this one fighter, Japanese fighter, was brought down. It was in a before we got there, some of our members were already there. Also, the Air Force had picked up the motors and whatever they thought was important. But they do still left quite a lot of pieces on the ground. Well, our fellows got those, and the object was that they would be cut up into small pieces, and every man in the battalion would get a piece to sort of commemorate the thing. Now, that's the crater.
Yes.
It made.
So we're looking at a photograph of Les's journal here, and we've got a crater of where the zero came down, a photograph of that.
And, of course, that's where the Japs were buried until they were dug up again, and I think they were cremated, mm-hmm. and I think because they were wearing their IDs, that urn was posted, or not posted, or I don't know how, was to go back to Japan. So
look, this was the action in Darwin, very well recorded with Les's beautiful photography and superb copperplate writing. And then come 1943, if we could slip ahead to that other booklet of yours there, the battalion is on its way on operations to New Guinea. So what were the first operations you took part in up there?
Well, before we moved to New Guinea, we came down to Adelaide for our first leave in 1943.
Yes.
And then, when that was over, we were sent to Queensland, where we learnt jungle training, patrol training, and which we didn't have at Darwin. Ours was going out into the scrub. Entirely different terrain. And so when we got to New Guinea, we did have the training of how to move and so on. Now, all our companies, and a company of 100 men, were sent to different places. We, Charlie Company, up at Well. And from Well, we continued some of our patrols, and also taking up ammunition, food, medical equipment to a more forward company. And that's what it was all about, learning how to use the terrain and to get to our other positions. And that went on right through 1943. And then my captain, Captain Nan, called me to his tent one morning and says, "Sir Major," he says, "I'm sending you back to Australia."
You were a sergeant by this time?
I was confused.
Yes.
I was a sergeant. Here he is calling me Sergeant Major. And I expected to be with my company for the duration of the war. But it wasn't to be. And I found myself in charge of about a dozen others. And we were driven down to Nabzab, which was the airfield. We were loaded on what we called a biscuit carrier because they rattled. Douglas 3, I think they were.
A DC-3, yes.
Yeah. And so we got on board. And the pilot said, he got us all together, he says, "I hope we can get through." He says, "Between here and Moresby," he says, "we stop at Moresby before going on to Australia," and he says, "there's no landing field." He said, "Japanese Zeros are still patrolling the skies." He says, "what I want to wish you is best of luck." What a way for send off, you know. Anyway, we got through and refueled at Moresby, then on to Sydney. And from then on, we went to Cowra. Now, just a short time before we arrived was the outbreak.
That was the 5th of August, 1944. Yes.
Yes. And that was a disaster. We lost two men. They had a machine gun and that kind of thing. But it was all over by the time we got there. I was designated the job and been sent to Canungra, truly in mountains area, and an ideal training ground for these young people, because once they qualified in their month, they would be sent to units that needed reinforcements.
Now, your particular responsibilities as an instructor at Canungra were weapons. What sort of weapons did you have to instruct in this?
Being an infantry NCO, I had to know all. The Owen, the Austin, light machine guns. Of course, the best weapon of all was the Lee Enfield, the 303. Then the Bren, oh, a mighty gun, that one, because you could fire it from the hip with accuracy. The throwing of grenades. Some of the young fellows were a bit nervous about that. But once they're throwing the first one, they got the idea and that kind of thing. And so they were all infantry weapons. Although later on we did get what they call the 2-inch mortar. It's only a small replica of a heavy 3-inch mortar, but the most important thing was that nobody told us how to use them, and some thought they rest on the knee because they had a sort of half moon shaped base and would fit over there, yeah, and of course it shattered their leg. But yes, I was there in 44, and I enjoyed what I was doing because I knew that this would eventually catch up with fighting units. And on one occasion, it was quite early morning before I had my platoon on work. I had a message that I was wanted at headquarters. So I went there, of course, correctly dressed, wearing my hat and all that kind of thing. And I came before the regimental sergeant major. Now, that man is a powerful man in a battalion. He is the number one NCO. His next rank would be an officer. But anyway, I got there and I said, "Do you want to see me, sergeant major?" He said, "Yes, I've been waiting for you." I said, "Oh, what I've been doing?" He says, "I'm due for leave." He said, "Overdue." He says, "You are the highest rank amongst all the sergeants. You're a sergeant major. Only you can take over my position. And that's what you're going to do." So for the next 2 weeks, I was acting first AITB Sergeant Major.
The 1st Australian Infantry Training Battalion, Regimental, or Battalion. Yes.
But as I said before, this battalion was actually equal to 3 battalions, the 1st, 2nd and 3rd. I was still the second highest rank.
So you'd be out on parade there?
I was on the dais.
On the dais, yep.
With the colonel. And then the colonel...
You had your pay stick?
Yeah, and then the colonel would turn to me and says, over to you, sir, major. So it was me to take charge to get all those companies, all those platoons on a day's work.
Right.
Because that's what it was, a day's work of training in weapons.
Did you stay up there right through the first half of 1945? Still up in Canungra? What happened to you?
Well, I was still there in 45. We knew nothing about the atomic bombs.
Yes.
But when we did hear about them, and especially Fat Man, the one that was detonated over the southern island, it was then that Japanese unconditionally surrendered. And it was then that the call comes through for the occupation.
So after Japan surrendered, there was a call for volunteers for the British Commonwealth Occupation Force of
yes.
Japan. You volunteered for
yep.
that. Why was that?
Because the bombing of Darwin, I wanted to see the finish positive, and that could only be in Japan.
And what was it like? What did you see when you got there?
In Japan?
Yes.
Well, we all saw a very sick nation. The people. Where they used to buy phosphates for their rice and wheat fields. They could no longer do that. So they used human excreta treatment. And of course, Japanese do not positively cook their veggie, whatever it might be, like we do. And when I made inquiries, 60% of the nation had gingivitis, yes. a disease of the gums. And that is just one of the horrors that even a foe, a country that goes to war, gives no consideration to the ordinary people. So many die in the repercussion of war, like the atomic bombs. It stopped the war, but Hiroshima alone, 60,000 died. And consequently, I wanted to see what happened. And two most important things happened to me. Being a sergeant major, I had to be sent to all infantry battalions besides the 65th, the 66th and 67th. Never even saw them or where they were stationed. But the 65th was 100 miles north of Hiroshima. The major said it's the last hope. When I got there, and the next morning, I went before the colonel, and he said, sorry, sir, major, we can't use you. I have my full quota of sergeant majors. He said, I'll have to send you back to Hiroshima. And then I said to him, sir, if I drop the rank to sergeant, can you use a sergeant? He looked at me and said, yes. A delight to my heart. I was 100 miles away from radiation. And as I later found out, he wanted a sergeant to teach the young people, young soldiers, to a standard of marching drill to go on guard in Tokyo, because every BCOF member had to take part. A part of duty was the guard duty in Tokyo. And so I was very pleased with that. And I was very pleased from the point of view that the ones I'd been helped trained, they were going, and I have a very nice picture of our guard platoons marching on in Tokyo.
Yes.
But that's all in these... This is Japan.
Now, you obviously felt compassion for the Japanese civilians. It's obvious in what you're saying. But you weren't allowed to fraternize, were you? There was a real problem about that, fraternizing between the BCOF and the Japanese population. Tell me about the difficulties that...
You do not know the Australian soldier. Because fraternization did go on. It was a natural thing. You heard about it in World War One with our soldiers and in Paris, mixing with the people, mm-hmm. although they were not the enemy. But fraternization is a part of a soldier. And I would like to tell you a story of my second day in Japan. The major said to me, he says, today I'm going to give you a leave pass. And he says, you have a good look around before you go to Fukuyama, where the 65th Battalion is stationed. So I walked to the centre. That was the city of Hiroshima. I looked around me. 1.25 square miles of nothing. The ground was black and only crisscrossed by the cement small pathways that were used by the Japanese people. It was their home area. I was standing there and suddenly I heard a sound behind me, or in front of me. And I heard it come quite close to me. And I turned around. And there was this Japanese man, I should say 35 to 40, casually dressed, long trousers, a jumper. He stood about just a meter from me. And I thought to myself, like so many hundreds of thousands, he wants to sell something, to buy food. And after a while, he bowed Japanese-wise to me. And then his face, and then he reached into a shirt pocket and brought out a package. I had no idea what it was, but my hand went to my pocket as if to give him some yen. He said, no. Then he handed it to me. And I thought, now what have I got here? So I opened it, because that it appears that's what he wanted me to do. And in it, it was such a pleasant shock, because there were photographs. There were photographs of Hiroshima before the bombing. And there was also the photographs of that building after the bombing. There was the explosion of little boy exploding. And there were so many different parts of that city that were crumbling. What better gifts could I have?
Sure.
So it was only then I said, arigato. The only word I knew for thank you.
Now we've found that stage in the album of Les Brown's with these photographs and that remarkable meeting where the Japanese presented them to him before the bomb fell, after the bomb exploded, that famous building that survives today as a skeleton, the before and after images of a number of structures in Hiroshima. A remarkable record here. This album of yours, for reasons of history, must be preserved. So you stayed in Japan till 1947?
Yes.
And then back to Australia?
Back to Adelaide.
What happened then?
Well, after my 2 weeks familiarisation,
yes,
back to civil life, I went back to the company I worked for and started work.
Yes.
I was back to where I started.
No longer the sergeant, no longer the acting regimental sergeant major, battalion sergeant major, back working as a civvy again.
Oh,
and
yes.
And what sort of jobs did you have to do?
Well, the same thing as I went in as a young fellow at 14, doorman and packer. But then I went back to scouting.
To therefore summarise your life and your times, you've seen some remarkable things, particularly, it would seem, in contact with the nation of Japan. You served against them in the war. You occupied their nation after the war as a member of the BCOF. You even represented your colonel at the War Crimes Tribunal. And then in years after the war, you've been to many events around the world involving Japanese scouts. What's your feeling, to summarise, bring everything up together, what's your feeling about Japan and its people today?
Of course, there are different generations. I have been back to Japan 4 times. And in fact, I've gone as a scout. I've worn my uniform as a scout. And I have done my swapping as a scout. But all my recollections of that are in my scouting logbooks, of which I have 120. And but I can show so easily how even the Japanese Boy Scouts, how they took to the admiring my campfire robe, because every badge has been swapped in scouting friendship.
And your feeling about Japanese society, Japan as a nation, what's the lasting feeling with you today?
It's a different Japan, of course. All the cities have been rebuilt. They have actually run a railway line right through the mountain range, which is in the centre of Japan. No cuttings, right through the mountains. And they have that wonderful new train that does over 120 miles an hour. And people travelling these days get to their destination so far, so quick. It's almost incredible. But as for the people, they are very friendly. I don't think that too many Japanese were told the truth about what happened during their war against the Pacific. I'm sure that the present generation are growing up into a peaceful country.